Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I am speaking today with Frank Schaefer, author, filmmaker, artist, and activist. He's the son of the late Francis and Edith Schaefer, founders of the Labrie Center in Switzerland and hugely influential on the origins of things like the Christian right, American evangelicalism, the evangelical and Republican anti-abortion movement, and Christian apologetics, intellectual Christianity sort of thing. Working closely with his famous father, Frank helped direct the 1977 film, How Should We Then Live? Another film Frank worked on in the late 70s and early 80s, along with his father and C. Everett Koop, was the anti-abortion pro-life series entitled Whatever Happened to the Human Race? Frank has stated that making this film is the greatest single regret of my life. And looking back on that period now, Frank writes on his blog, quote, my family played a wretched leading role in the continuing oppression, denigration, and abuse of women. I am so very sorry. I've spent the last 30 plus years of my life trying to undo some of the harm I did. As the fight for the Supreme Court heats up, I see my dad's fingerprints all over it with an assist from me, end quote. After leaving evangelicalism and right-wing evangelical politics, Frank now describes himself as, quote, an atheist who believes in God. Politically, he's gone from being a very conservative Republican to as a young man to now being an outspoken liberal Democrat. So welcome, Frank Schaefer, to Mind Shift Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And I apologize again for that lengthy introduction, but for the maybe one or two people who don't know who you are, I figure it is good to sort of set the context, where you came from, and I'm sure we'll have a fantastic discussion about all this stuff, especially the Amy Coney Barrett and all the stuff that's going on in Trump world at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully a changing situation that in the election is going to shift, but for the moment, we're stuck with Trump world, as you call it, and unfortunately, the ramifications and the effect on American history is far from over. No matter who wins the election, this is going to roll on for a long time because the evangelical right wing has not only become energized, it's now militarized. And I mean that in the most literal sense. When you have Trump followers who are now not only evangelicals, but also Trump followers who are in all these far-right white supremacist militias plotting to kidnap governors, murder, and all the rest of it. We've got a scene here which is so far removed from everything that I knew back in the 70s and 80s when I was an instigator with my father and Dr. C. Everett Koop, who became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General of the pro-life movement, that it almost doesn't seem like the same universe. So the evolution of the movement that we were part of back then and that I regret has taken a turn towards the right and towards authoritarianism and violence and armed conflict and so forth, that even in our worst case imagination and scenarios back in those days, we never would have envisaged. And I think, you know, one thing I'd like to just start by saying is that my own journey out of the religious right began just with an awareness of the ugliness and hypocrisy that was part and parcel with so much of the leadership. But where it has ended up essentially makes me think of that old parable of the frog that you put in water and you turn the heat up a few degrees every mm-hmm. hour. And eventually the frog is killed and boiled to death and never knows that it's dying and never hops out of the water. So even if I was still a faithful evangelical in a time capsule from the period where my family was most influential in the 70s and 80s and suddenly was transported to the 2020 election as we close in on it, I would be stunned and amazed. And I would say, how on earth could you get from there where we were to here? I would be upbraiding the evangelical brothers and sisters in Christ and saying, what have you done? And that would be if I was still a faithful member of that movement. So you can only imagine from my perspective, having gotten out of it, the way I view this. So that's sort of a preamble that sets up, you know, a look back at this and my own part in it.
I think it's really important to talk to you for a variety of reasons, as you say, because you were there. You're one of the first people, well, you're the only person I've actually ever talked to who met R.J. Rush Dooney, the father of Christian Reconstructionism. You were there with your famous father. I read his books as a young evangelical. I wrote a master's thesis, and I used a lot of your father's argument in terms of Christian worldview and all this kind of stuff around, you know, the New Testament interpretation. So your father was hugely influential on me just personally. And yet, as you say, you've kind of gone, I mean, you've got a book. I was looking at your book, 2007, you came out with this book, Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. So this is clearly your project, at least for the last however many years, isn't it?
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, thinking about R.J. Rush Dooney, or Rush as we used to call him, I stayed with him in California for 3 days once in his home as his guest, back when we were looking for allies to promote our anti-abortion film series, Whatever Happened to the Human Race. Back in those days, my father regarded him as a sort of a useful ally, but also as an extremist. One of the reasons Dad viewed RJ as so dangerous and did not actually want to be associated with him by name, for instance, make a film series together or co-author a book or be seen on the same platform, Dad refused to do all those things because he saw in RJ, I guess, the fingerprints of, you know, the future, the kind of movement that we've now seen in Trump's America, where RJ was talking about hanging gay people and executing women who had had abortions. And he called childcare for preschool children infanticide, talked about the fact that women had to not only be subservient to their husbands, but should not have careers. You know, this at the time had very little influence in a direct manner, but he did influence a whole circle of evangelical thinkers who then went on and began to teach and write in ways that eventually produced what we might say a Mike Pence, a person who's out there legislatively trying and with a much softer touch to put through an Old Testament theocratic vision of America where gay marriage would be banned, where abortion would be banned, where women would be subservient to husbands and so forth. And then when you come to Amy Coney Barrett, you know, she's part of People of Praise, which is a Roman Catholic offshoot of Charismatic offshoot. But when you look at what people who have left the movement, many of whom, by the way, recently have been emailing me saying, thank you for criticizing her. Nobody has any idea how bad it was being raised in People of Praise. Thank you for speaking up. In fact, I have a three single space pages email from someone going through their whole family history of what it did to the women in the family and how they were subservient to the men and the way it broke up the marriages and the harsh discipline of children and so forth, particularly leaning on daughters in issues of modesty, what sort of underwear they could wear, what sort of jeans they could wear, the size of the belt buckle, anti-contraceptives, all the rest of this. So I'm 68, and because as a teen and a young man, as the nepotistic sidekick of my father in the 70s and 80s, I saw this whole arc. And 2 points I'd like to bring out that I know that you'll be interested in, and then we can talk about details. One, most evangelicals don't realize that when my dad and I and Dr. Koop came on the scene with Whatever Happened to the Human Race, it wasn't secular feminists we were trying to talk into our position. It was other evangelicals who were pro-choice. I'll repeat that. They were pro-choice. Mm-hmm. They weren't just ambivalent. Dr. Billy Graham, the evangelist, was pro-choice when we talked to him about the series and said, why don't you endorse it? No, I cannot, Francis, he said. I cannot endorse a series that picks out women for a special kind of burden when I'm trying to call them to Christ and tell them that Jesus died for them and loves them. So he did this on an evangelical basis. Mm. W.A. Criswell, the president of the Southern Baptist Commission, who was such a fundamentalist that he was on a crusade at the time to fire professors from their seminaries in the Southern Baptist Convention who had a, quote, weak view of scripture, did not sign on to inerrancy. He was the fundamentalist fundamentalist. He actually had Bible verses he was lining up to argue for legal abortion in terms of the quickening in the womb, the Old Testament law saying that if you caused a miscarriage, you were punished with a fine. But, you know, if the baby died but not the mother, it was not murder. All these kind of things. He had actually staked out a position. So the first point I'd like to make is evangelicals think that somehow the evangelical position has always been anti-abortion. It has not. We had to argue with the editors of Christianity Today magazine. I started a rival newspaper called The Christian Activist in the 70s and the 80s to go after them and say, why aren't they taking a stand? Dr. Graham, Billy Graham, never took a stand. Criswell did not. The editors of Christianity Today did not. The whole establishment of the evangelical community, the backbone of the fundamentalist movement in America, was ambivalent towards and or pro-choice. And that's what changed till now. It's the Republican litmus test, and Trump was elected. The second point I'd like to make is that when it came to the theonomists or the Reconstructionists and Rushdoony and Chilton and all these other figures who I knew personally, they were already overtly calling for a theocracy. In other words, they were an anti-democracy group of Christians back in the 60s and 70s who already had rejected American democracy in exactly the way that evangelicals are now going along with Trump, saying, well, if the election's lost, it's because it was rigged. He should hold on to power. Greater good is coming out of this, portraying him almost as a biblical king. Come to save the people of Israel, being the American evangelicals. The basis for all this kind of radicalized militia thinking, in as much as it has overlapped into the evangelical right-wing circles, the whole gun ownership thing, the whole Second Amendment thing, Rush Dooney was all over that. He was a racist. He believed that slavery was ordained by God. The views he expressed through the Chalcedon Foundation were so extreme that his own followers mostly did so either in secret or quoted the less dramatically offensive parts of his work. But his influence was huge on people, for instance, like Franklin Graham, who now is a political figure and supporter of Trump. It was huge on people like Ralph Reed, who is a key organizer of the evangelical political movement. So in a way, it was like a time bomb. Rush Dooney lit this fuse and let the bomb go off in the 60s and 70s. Only now, 40, 50 years later, has it come to fruition in the Trump years. And when you look at, for instance, what the Federalist organization is doing in place in training for 30 years and placing judges onto the federal bench, and who has given Trump the list of judges to nominate, many of these men were young evangelicals and Roman Catholics who were influenced or infected by my dad's book, A Christian Manifesto, by him going around the country calling young lawyers to get into law to eventually become judges. The exact thing that has happened is something that my father laid out as an agenda, as did Rush Dooney, in the late 60s, 1970s, and early 80s. And now it's actually come to pass in the Trump era. So for me, it's sort of like Alice through the Looking Glass. You know, I've seen all this before in terms of the blueprints of what actually happened. It wasn't a conspiracy. No one person was in charge. It was simply the power of ideas and slow motion sort of catching on. So, so you know, for me to have lived through the beginning of this, when we were talking evangelicals and, quote, taking a position on the life issues, all the way to the point where now you cannot be a, quote, unquote, real Christian unless you're voting Republican, is such a dramatic arc of change, not just in the secular culture, but in the evangelical culture, which is no longer recognizable as being a sort of a Jesus-centered, Christ-driven movement. It's totally politicized. It's very angry. It's armed. It's dangerous. It winks and nods at overt violence, kidnapping governors, and all the rest of this is getting dog whistles on everything from racism to violent overthrow of governors elected in Democratic-controlled states. None of this is a surprise to me, but what surprises me is that it has actually happened. I never thought back in those days this would take place.
You're seeing
it now. That's kind of a long, crazy, rambling history, but I'm trying to give you some sort of perspective on this arc.
Yes, I read your article on your blog where you talk about some of those points that you just raised about how back in the 70s, you couldn't pay to get anyone to endorse you and your father's movie at the time. And that's so incongruous because as we see now, the narrative spoken by the Christian right is almost to the minute that Roe versus Wade was passed, they were outraged, they were offended and angry, and they've been doing everything since 1973 to get this thing overturned. So that's what Jerry Falwell said. I heard the news on the radio. I read it in the newspaper and I was outraged and I went out and tried to get everybody against it. No, that's absolutely not the case. And we know that it was a political thing. Guys like Paul Weyrich, they were saying, how can we get Catholics and Christians to vote Reagan in office? So abortion became the topic of the day around about 1979, 1980. So there's a completely different storyline, really, isn't there, than the official version that you hear from the evangelicals?
Yeah, the thing is, all the evangelical leaders who weren't simply in it for the money were in it for the power. And if they were well-intended, it was power so they could change things in favor of what they believed to be morally correct, or it was just power in itself. And they were looking for hinges upon which to turn the movement and upon which to raise funds. And this became very convenient to them. And it dovetailed with people like my friend Jack Kemp, who was a congressman, went on to be a vice presidential candidate with Bob Dole and other folks. You know, we used to stay in his home when we were in Washington and speaking there, and other folks like him. And what happened was, is it became a marriage of convenience between conservative Republicans who were pushing at that stage what was known as sort of trickle-down economics of you know, cutting taxes and all the rest, and they were trying to roll back any kind of environmental protection, things that didn't exactly excite evangelicals or bring them into the movement. Once we were able to turn this into a moral crusade of sorts, then they had a shorthand saying, okay, we'll be on your side on this, you know, as long as you're with us when it comes to bolstering the work of the Koch brothers and the oil business and all the rest. And you've got to get behind us on that stuff, and we'll get behind you on abortion and gay rights and all these other things. So there was a trade-off. It wasn't as quite as cynical as this sounds, as if there were three guys in a back room somewhere doing it, but that's the way the movement coalesced. That's what happened. So evangelicals were dragged kicking and screaming in the arena. You know, this was a Roman Catholic issue along with contraceptive. It was part of the contraceptive ban. That's how it was seen by evangelicals. As my dad first said to me when Dr. Koop proposed the series, why would I get into a Roman Catholic issue? That was my father's reaction. So he had to be talked into it by his old friend, C. Everett Koop. And I got on board because I was an ambitious young sidekick to my father looking for my next job. Plus, I was fired up by Koop and became a true believer in the cause for a number of years, and so on and so on. But to give you a graphic example, I just watched a documentary on Dolly Parton, and I was reminded in seeing her 50th anniversary show in the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville that when we rented the Grand Ole Opry for our film series on history and culture, How Should We Then Live, we filled it. We sold every single seat in the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. 4 years, was it, or 5 years later, when we came back with Whatever Happened to the Human Race, our series on abortion, we couldn't fill the front row. All right? Wow. Same churchy evangelical community. My father had not been sleeping with his secretary. There had been no scandal. Dad's books were selling off the chart. I was on the Today Show with Jane Pauley arguing that our books were getting blacklisted and weren't being counted in the New York Times bestseller list. We were all over the place. The other film series was selling beautifully and renting. When we brought out Whatever Happened to the Human Race on Abortion, nobody wanted to know. Same audience, same distributor, same cast of characters. It was like pulling teeth. And it took 5 years of Dad meeting with Falwell, Robertson, with Focus on the Family, Dr. Dobson, and these other guys to talk them into even making statements on these issues to various degrees. And then all of a sudden, when Jack Kemp jumped in, when Dad met with the Bush family, when Ronald Reagan got involved, even though he had legalized abortion in California, but he decided to use this. You know, I was there when Reagan spoke to the national religious broadcasters, and he was brought in by Weyrich and also at that point by Pat Robertson. I was involved with those meetings, and it was a bold-faced attempt to simply capture the vote. It had nothing to do with the moral issue. And of course, in Trump, you see the epitome of that. And obviously, the man is not pro-life or pro-anything. He's just about himself and his own malignant narcissism. That's how it all began. So it became a marriage of convenience. And then I'm not saying that rank and file evangelical Christians, once they got into the issues and once they started starting crisis pregnancy centers to help people with pregnancies and so forth and so on, I'm not saying they were not sincere. I think the rank and file often were very sincere, but they were being led by people who were seeking political power and using this as a wedge issue.
Well, my wife worked for years and years in a crisis pregnancy center in the States. And as you say, she was herself post-abortive. And so as a perfect example of what you're just describing, she was absolutely all in. She was not picketing abortion clinics. She wasn't, you know, shooting abortion doctors and all those kind of things. But she thought genuinely she was helping other men and women to get forgiveness, and it was all wrapped in the Christian context. And yet now, as an ex-evangelical, she's looking back on all those years and saying, wait a minute, how much of this guilt and shame that was heaped on me through the church was because of all this stuff going on?
So now when you look and you see this marriage between the far right and these militias, for instance, and the pro-life movement, the kind of unthinkable aspect of this, as I said, you know, talking to you a few minutes ago, when you look at Rushdoony and what he was calling for, the kind of armed resistance to secularism, put it this way, the armed resistance to anything that came after the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason or science, and wanting to roll back to an Old Testament style theocracy, with the laws of the Old Testament being imposed by the federal government, you understand that these crazy lunatics running around with automatic weapons outside a governor's house or charging in to protest wearing masks to prevent people from getting coronavirus. But the seeds of all this stuff, the paranoia, the conspiracy theories, none of this came out of thin air. This is the Reconstructionist project. Now, the irony is that half of these doofuses with their AR-15s and flak jackets and high-capacity magazines have not heard of any of these folks. But the energy that got their movement going was comes right out of Valsito, California, or wherever Rushdoony was. And those meetings that we were all having back in the day. So that's where it all happened. And as you said, I was there. And of course, you mentioned my memoir, Crazy for God, which I forget when it was published, but it's been out a while. That tells the story of our family's involvement, but also tangentially the rise of the whole movement for people who want to study that. So I've actually been invited to a number of universities to meet with graduate students who are using the book as a history text in both history and also comparative religion texts and so forth in Rice University and Princeton and other places, because it's a document now that unfortunately is all too relevant. You know, when I wrote it at the time, I thought it was past history. I didn't know I was explaining the American present and future.
It makes sense. Well, there's a podcast, speaking of going back to your point about these far-right militias, it's called the No Compromise Podcast, and they're doing an investigative series on these brothers, the Doerr brothers, D-O-R-R, and they're big in the sort of God and guns movement right now, and they are Christian Reconstructionists, so they know the inside line on guys like Rushdoony. They actually know his theology, but when they popularize it to the sort of hard far-right militia groups, they don't explain that. It's all about Second Amendment rights and God and guns and Trump, and so, yeah, I'm absolutely agreeing with you. Some of these far-right militia groups, man, they're right in there with Rushdoony's project from decades ago.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of evangelical types who justify their support of Trump by saying, yes, he's evil, yes, he's a malignant narcissist, yes, he's an adulterer, yes, he's this, yes, he's that, but he's being used by God in some greater plan. And of course, that would fit right in with Rushdoony too. Mm-hmm. So essentially, God's using an evil agent to bring about change on earth, and there's biblical examples of this, as you know, and so on. So either way, the influence of the Reconstructionists is high right now.
It's
and
huge.
It can't be overestimated. And the crazy thing is to think that it won the day. In other words, you know, we were worried back in the 70s and 80s that Christianity Today magazine was too soft on the abortion issue. Turns out that, you know, what was actually going to transpire in the end is that evangelicalism would be defined by a kind of fascist, racist Christianity with a no-holds-barred liar at the helm in a self-dealing family that looks like something out of the New Jersey mob, running the country into the ground, and in the midst of this pandemic, you know, exacerbated by events, who could have foreseen that? But the support that he got from evangelicals and is still getting from evangelicals, the groundwork for that was laid in theological terms. Mm-hmm. And has never gone away, and is still very relevant to what's going on.
Absolutely. We We will be right back in just a few minutes with the second half of my chat with Frank Schaefer. We are going to get into the issue of the confirmation hearings of Amy Coney Barrett for the Supreme Court in the United States. And I'm really interested to hear Frank's perspective, especially as this issue of abortion is a single topic issue animating Republicans, evangelicals alike. And of course, as we've said, he and his father were hugely influential in getting that movement off the ground back in the 1970s and the 1980s, which he has since disavowed and is now a vocal critic of what's going on, as you've no doubt already heard. Now, I want to mention really quickly what is coming up in the next few weeks, the next few episodes here on Mindshift Podcast. Well, coming out this Friday, this is a bonus episode, but the actual next episode that's going to drop kind of dovetails with what Frank and I are talking about. I am speaking with Heath Brown, who is just coming out in January of next year with a book, Educating the Christian Right, talking about how the Christian right uses Christian homeschool kids in their political campaigns. And of course, this absolutely dovetails with everything we've been saying all along, talking about R.J. Reshetuni, Christian Reconstructionism, his impact on the Christian homeschooling movement, and seeing that as a generational thing, a very long-term thing whereby over generations, as kids are raised in a Christian home, raised in a Christian homeschooling environment, they will then be inculcated with a quote-unquote biblical worldview, as it were, go out and take the world for Christ. And this was Rush Dooney's view. That's why he was so instrumental in getting Christian homeschooling off the ground back in the 1970s and the 1980s. And so that's a really important discussion with Heath Brown coming up. And then after that, I've got an episode dropping with Dr. John Fia. We're going to be talking about the origins of the Christian right. He's done a tremendous amount of research and writing and scholarship around that whole area. So that's going to be a very fascinating topic with Dr. John Fia coming up probably right before the election. So watch out for that. I also wanted to give a shout out to the newest Patreon supporters of Mindshift Podcast. Thank you to Eric Reese and Colleen O'Neill for your support. They get to be part of the closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And it's in there that we have our closed Mindshift Podcast Zoom calls every month. And in fact, just in a few weeks here, we're going to have Paul Kibble drop in. And on the 25th of October, he's going to be talking about his work on Christian hegemony. Then we've got actually two calls in the month of November. We've got Peter Montgomery of the Right Wing Watch, and then followed in the end of the month by Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead of the book Taking America Back for God. So we've actually got two calls in the month of November, and this is really cool. After we finished recording, I mentioned to Frank Schaefer that we would love to have him come in as a guest, so I'm working on getting Frank to drop in maybe in early December, hopefully before the holidays. That would be absolutely fantastic. So that is a really great benefit that you get for being a supporter of this show on Patreon, as well as you get early access to the episodes on Patreon about 3 days before they normally drop on a Friday. So if you're interested in supporting me on Patreon, the link for that, as always, is in the show notes. All right, let's get on back into the conversation with Frank Schaefer. We're now going to start turning and taking a look at this issue of Amy Coney Barrett, her nomination to the Supreme Court, which is obviously going to get rammed through. The Republicans are in control of the Senate, and so this is essentially a done deal. This is power politics at work. This is the establishment of a theocracy as Frank Schaefer sees it. So let's go on and finish the second half of the chat and hear what Frank has to say about Amy Coney Barrett. So now we have Amy Coney Barrett. She's, as we're doing this recording, she's right in the middle of her confirmation hearings. What I find fascinating is she's evading answers left, right, and center. They're asking her direct questions about her legal opinion on abortion and on whether or not a president should cede power if he loses the election. And she keeps evading and evading and evading. And yet you write, I love this quote, you say that Amy Coney Barrett is William Barr in a skirt. Barrett could have been quoting Barr when she said in a speech at Notre Dame, quote, a legal career is but a means to an end, and that end is building the kingdom of God. So yeah. Amy Coney Barrett, what's going to happen if she, in fact, well, she's going to, because the Senate is controlled by the Republican Party.
Yeah.
This is just a farce. We all know that. This is just a political show, political theater. So she's going to get, what happens then after she gets on the bench?
You know, because of her evangelical background and you've been a pastor and your wife was a pro-life activist and so forth, just like I know, you can only imagine what was going on in the back room prayer meetings before all these hearings where Amy's friends and family and pastor and husband were all laying hands on her, praying for the Holy Spirit to give her the words, invoking Psalms, invoking prayers, invoking Proverbs and so forth, all part of a 30-year project of the Federalist Society to put conservative judges on the bench, informed by religious fervor when it comes to Amy Coney Barrett, which basically looks at what she's been doing as a long arc of God's will being exercised within her life to get in there and make changes. Now, those changes that she calls constitutional and so forth are all going to be in the direction of rolling back the civil rights that have been hard won by gay people, transgender people, Black Americans, and women. Mm-hmm. Because her view, the view of the Pentecostal movement she comes from, is that America is sort of the new Zion set on the hill, the true people of Israel, that the destiny of the U.S. on earth is to be this shining light, and the shining light is to preach the cause of Christ, bring people to Jesus, and the ones that don't come to Jesus at least have to live within a state that is controlled by what they call Judeo-Christian ideas, and essentially is imposing on the whole country exactly what the founding fathers in the Bay State Colony of Massachusetts were fleeing from the U.K. when they left the state church there that was trying to impose their system of belief on them and persecuting them for deviating. So we've come full circle. And then, of course, when the Puritans got to the Bay State Colony, the first thing they did is set up, you know, what the Republicans would call socialist communes, where you had to participate. So that's sort of ironic. But
kind of theocracy.
Essentially, little theocracies.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's what Amy Coney Barrett is trying to get back to. That would be her version of the good old days when everybody had to go to church and they thought in one particular way and so forth. So to put it in a modern context, the vision that Rush Dooney is now playing out within people like Amy Coney Barrett, who may or may not even have read his theology. My guess is that she knows who he is. But when you look, for instance, at William Barr and the speech he gave at Notre Dame 6 months ago or 3 months ago, whenever it was, that I quoted a lot and wrote about, he came right out and said that we're in a culture war between this liberal elite and God-fearing Americans, et cetera, laid out an agenda, equated Trump with the defense of that agenda. None of these people equating Trump as a kind of an intellectual force in defense of it, but simply that he has adopted this as his means to reelection. This is his path to power. And obviously this is the will of God. And Barr has shown he's willing to deform the Justice Department to conform to what Trump needs politically, and has used his powers of investigation and all the rest of it in ways that are completely off the chart. So when you look at Amy Coney Barrett, we know exactly what she's going to do and how she's going to vote on every issue. And one of the things, which is less dramatic than Roe v. Wade, is the way that her consistent writing and thinking, for instance, has been always on the side of corporate power and interests of private enterprise against the individual and the worker. So in addition to everything else, these folks are going to fix to roll back not only the states to a pre-Enlightenment state of theocracy if they get their way, but also the gains made in terms of any kind of social services and safety net that Roosevelt brought in and that has grown through those years with Lyndon Johnson and the Voting Rights Act and so forth and so on. They see all that as the enemy of their vision of America. And so whether it is siding with voter suppression to keep Black people from voting, whether it is rolling back attempts to change the gerrymandering structure in districts, any place they can touch, environmental protection, all the rest of it, they are going to go for an agenda which is completely molded in terms of corporate interests. So for them, the idea of free enterprise, gun rights ownership, all these other things which the right wing, the NRA, and all these people tote, that's their agenda. And it's their agenda as a kind of a quid pro quo with these conservative folks who don't care about things like abortion or gay rights. Look, we will scratch your back. We will bring America back to you know, to roll back environmental protection so you can continue with whatever you want to do in terms of industrial expansion and shareholder interest. And then in turn, you back us on this other stuff we care about. That's the agreement. And so in Amy Coney Barrett, you've got the whole package. You have a brilliant woman, highly educated, a complete religious nutcase, part of a small group where she herself was a handmaid in charge of other women, telling them who to marry and what relationships they could go into, a kind of a control freak situation. She's now being launched on the country by Donald Trump, and he could care less about the issues, but is doing this in a power play to try to continue getting votes from evangelical Christians that are his only identifiable voter bloc. Without that voter bloc, he's not president. Vladimir Putin didn't make him president. White evangelicals did.
It's true.
So that's the full circle. That's who she is, and that's where she fits in. And it's not an accident. The Federalist Society and other right-wing organizations who have been funded by people like the Koch brothers to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars have trained and raised up a series of very brilliant, brainwashed, far-right people who, from high school on, were put into this movement as, you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to be a judge, we're going to pay for your education, we're going to mentor you, you're going to be coming to these meetings, we're going to keep you in informed from our point of view, you're going to go to liberal schools, you're going to go to Harvard so you get the right degrees, but you're going to go to our meetings too. We're going to keep you in line with your faith. Many of them are evangelicals or conservative Catholics. So it's all one package. And now these guys have launched themselves through Trump into our judicial process.
And we can see, as you say, it is a totally cynical power play, because the last year of Obama's presidency, when Merrick Garland was being promoted as a potential Supreme Court judge, here's Mitch McConnell, here's Lindsey Graham saying, oh, no, no, it's in principle, we should not appoint a judge in the final year of any president. That's just not right. Let's wait until after the election. Whoever wins the next election, we'll give them a fair shake, blah, blah, blah. Weeks before the election, they are shoving Amy Coney Barrett through. So it's a complete cynically motivated power play. And I was thinking about your father too, because the fact that Amy Coney Barrett is evading very direct and clear questions, you can just look at her writings. And I was thinking, you know, going back to Francis Schaeffer and A Christian Manifesto, he's talking about this idea of having a Christian worldview. In other words, as I understand it, the idea that every aspect of life has to be governed by a Christian or biblical worldview. And to me, I look at Amy Coney Barrett and I think, here's a woman who every decision, every position she's taken is informed by, in her view, a Christian biblical worldview. So again, I would see, I don't know how you, if you would plug your father's contribution into that kind of thinking in terms of his book, A Christian Manifesto.
Yeah, it's exactly what he called for. And, you know, in the years when he was fighting cancer, one of the things we did is we went to Oral Roberts University to speak there for a couple of weeks of in and out meetings with John Whitehead, who then started the Rutherford Organization, which was exactly supposed to be a counterpart to the American Civil Liberties Union and bring the defense of Christian civil liberties into the role of law. And they started their law school precisely because Dad and others like Rush Dooney had called for Christians, as it were, to get into the business of training up a whole generation of people, a kind of a slow motion change, and it worked. And then, of course, the next step was, look, a degree from ORU isn't going to get you very far. So we're going to set up these organizations on campuses like Harvard and so forth. So when you're in the law school there, it will do what the Chinese Communist Party does, and that is they'll send their top students to the States to study, but they'll also make sure that they're in touch with ideological, like-minded people the whole time, so you can keep meeting with people that the Communist Party approves of and make sure that you don't deviate too far. It's the way all cults, sects, political parties, underground organizations have always operated. And so you look at someone like Amy Coney Barrett. She's been part of an organization which has basically helped her keep her faith by a very kind of tough set of guidelines. The whole family's involved now. You know, it's not even a matter of choice. At a certain point, your actual brain changes and you think in that way. So she would think on two levels. There would be her spiritual life, which she would keep very private and believe very sincerely. And then there's the legal life. The legal life is informed by political ambition to change America. The private spiritual life is what gives her the powerful dynamic to hang in there against all the evidence, against, for instance, environmental evidence, where she's asked, what do you think of climate change? And she says, well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't say. I mean, when you hear that, you know she's bought the whole package.
Right.
Because she could have broken at that point and said, climate change is real. We ought to do something about it. How could that hurt her? No.
Or it's all a hoax.
she's bought the whole package.
Yep.
And when I heard that, then I knew exactly who she was, because that's her moment when she could declare herself to be someone who has a little smidgen of free thought left in her brain and is not just a cult member, but like an automaton, she repeats the phrase, no, I'm not a scientist. So there's a lot of discussion about this.
Just
so not only did she pretend, you know, she went through the entire hearing pretending to not have any set beliefs.
Exactly.
And every single question given an opportunity to declare herself as, for instance, even having a view of science, which is educated, she took the kind of white evangelical out. Oh, well, I'm not a scientist. I can't comment. Well, we all know what that really means. And that is that when she rules on anything in which it's a corporate interest up against the environment, it's the corporation that's going to win. And that's going to be because of her vision, not of corporate America, but of God having given us dominion over the earth. The Reconstructionists are called dominionists. That's the whole point. We were given dominion over the earth. That's how they argued slavery. That's how they argue the rape of the environment. It's this whole dominionist idea that God has this order of events. It's the same way, for instance, that the apartheid folks in South Africa used to argue for the racial subjugation of the inferior black population, as they would see it. We've been around this block 1,000 times. We understand it. And here it is again in 2020 and 2021. And we're back at square one again. That's the stunning thing for me.
We're back in the shit.
Back in the shit. And we happen to be back in the 12th century.
Yeah.
Because by the 13th and 14th century, the Medici are coming along in Florence and saying, well, when Galileo shows up, we'll give him a lab to work in, because maybe we need more than witchcraft and priests and mumbo jumbo to get us through the next crisis. You know, let's look at this science thing. So essentially what we're doing is we're taking the history of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the age of science, discovery, and we're rolling it back and just saying, let's pretend none of this happened. And go back to some idea of biblical absolutes and law for our foundation, which then they call being originalist with the Constitution. And we know, of course, that, you know, the folks who wrote that document, if you were really originalist, we would re-legalize slavery. We would not have any black votes. We'd have no emancipation of women. So this is just a pretend game, but the real game is a spiritual one. They would see as spiritual warfare fighting against principalities and powers and so on. So I say again, just picture the prayer meeting she had in some hotel room just before she launched every day into those hearings. You know exactly what they were like.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we've sweaty holding of hands, heads bowed, we just this and we just that, and then go forth, spiritual warrior Amy, and do your thing. And just please don't mention the fact that one of the things we believe in our group that we're sending you forth to put forward as a woman is the subjugation of women to their husband's will. Just don't mention that part, because that's the whole handmade thing that she belonged to, was women telling other women to be subject to their husband's will, that men are in charge. This is part of God's design. She believes every word of that. And that's her whole thing. So, you know, the ultimate irony is we have a very powerful, educated woman who's using that position of power and education to put herself in a position to bring the law back in tune with what she believes are biblical absolutes. And no one's allowed to ask her about that, or that's persecuting Christians.
Exactly. That's it. You can't talk about her faith, because that's religious persecution.
Right.
And yet we know, I mean, I listened to a podcast. There was an interview of Marjorie Dannenfelser, who's the head of the Susan B. Anthony List, which is an evangelical anti-abortion organization. And she said that Amy Coney Barrett has been carefully vetted for a long time for this role. So as you say, this is not, she didn't just walk out on the stage. She's had carefully rehearsed scenarios where they've talked through, here's some questions you'll probably be asked. Here's how you respond. Here's what you say. Don't get controversial. Avoid really answering any question. And yet the written record is all there. Her teachings, you know, you can't, we've got the receipts. We know what her positions are on abortion and other things. And she refuses to take a position.
Well, I think one of the big mistakes that a lot of secular commentators make that maybe you and I don't make because we know more people in the movement is this idea that somehow a very educated, qualified person cannot at the same time be a delusional fanatic. Mm. And we know people who have PhDs and all sorts of stuff, but who also operate in another part of their brains in a complete fantasy world of spiritual evangelical delusion. And guess what? That's not limited to Christianity.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the stunning things about a lot of the Islamic-inspired terrorism around the world is how many doctors, lawyers, engineers have been involved in carrying bombs on themselves. These are guys who graduated from the London School of Economics. These are people who were doctors. So religious fanaticism and delusion in Hindu India right now, with Modi making nationalism and Hinduism synonymous and persecuting the Muslim minority. These aren't uneducated people. This isn't peasants with pitchforks. These mm-hmm. are educated people who have also been brainwashed or self-deluded into a way of seeing the world in which their brains are split between your engineering degree. That's on Thursday. But on Friday, I'm putting on a bomb belt and I'm going to blow the hell out of a preschool. Mm. This is the same guy.
Yeah.
So this kind of conceit of the secular, uninformed view of religious fanaticism that says, but if you've been to Cambridge, if you studied medicine at Oxford, if you're a Harvard grad or you clerked for Scalia on the court, surely this can't be so. You can't, only stupid people believe in the literal resurrection or the virgin birth or that gay people choose this sinful lifestyle. Surely her education would have changed that view. No. And if you look at who the fanatics in Germany were, the educated, mm-hmm. well-spoken, well-read culture of German Lutheranism that went for Hitler. They saw in Hitler a savior of evangelical faith from the incipient overtaking of the age of reason and science and atheism and communism. But it's always the same discussion. And then when you bring it up, it's, wait a minute, you know, you're an Islamophobe or you're anti-Hindu or mm-hmm. you're mocking Christianity. And I say, look, we can't be afraid to say, ideas have consequences. And if Amy Coney Barrett believes this because she's a Christian, then we have to talk about her beliefs and argue with them. And of course, I think the same thing about Wahhabist Islam. You cannot mm-hmm. look at the Saudi royal family and pretend the only problem is that they all have apartments in Paris and they're corrupt. The problem is they have backed their version of Rushduni for 50 mm-hmm. years and have spread terror worldwide because of it. So the nutty thing is that Rushduni is more similar to the imams of Wahhabist theology than he is to Christianity.
Yeah.
In the way I was raised on it. And Amy Coney Barrett is more, her vision of the world fits in better with the Ayatollahs of Iran than it does with where somebody like Billy Graham was in 1952 when he desegregated his crusades based mm-hmm. on the love of Jesus and the gospel. So not only do we have to be able to question people's faith and draw dotted lines and say, yeah, but if you believe this here, this is the result. We have to be willing to also educate the people around us to understand that education itself is no guarantee that you won't have religious fanaticism. Secondly, that religious fanaticism can't be cured simply by secular argument, that you have to argue with the belief system. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you have to open yourself to being criticized as being, quote, anti-religious. But this victimology of claiming, oh, I'm being persecuted because someone said that my Christian faith informs my homophobia. So let's just talk about the legislative program. Let's not talk about the fact that I think that gays are lying and none of them were born gay and they can all choose to be straight and we can re-educate them. Let's not draw the line between that. Or let's not draw the line between the subjugation of women in the Bible. That's anti-religious. And mm-hmm. my belief that is going to take away contraceptive coverage by insurance companies of women who work for companies owned or run by corporate interests that are evangelical.
Yeah. Hobby Lobby.
Yeah, so I think the next step of secular criticism of people like Amy Coney Barrett or the Wahhabists of Saudi Arabia or the Iranian mullahs, the liberal knee-jerk reaction is, oh, I don't want to appear as if I'm Islamophobic, so I can't criticize Amy Coney Barrett. In fact, I was talking to one of the founders of MoveOn.org the other day, which is a big political organization. She said, boy, I'd like to say more about Amy Coney Barrett, but I'll be accused of being anti-religious. And, you know, if you do that, then people will say, well, that's the same as being anti-Islamic because you talk about terrorism. I said, look, the hell with that. The chips are on the table. We have to be honest now. I don't care if I'm accused of being anti-religious. I'm not anti-religious in my view. But that said, I'm willing to take the heat because we can't pretend that there's not a dotted line between the Saudi royal family and every terrorist activity we've seen in the last 50 years. There is a direct dotted line, and it's a theological one. And we cannot pretend that Amy Coney Barrett is not the product of Reconstructionism, which comes directly out of a form of fascist Christianity, which was embraced by the Lutheran Church during the age of Adolf Hitler. It's the same thing. So enough with the niceties. This is me talking here. I'm not going to put this on you. Let's just call it what it is. And that is, all fundamentalist religion is the enemy of progress and enlightenment and science, period. All fundamentalist religion.
It's true.
His Hindu nationalism, Wahhabist Islam, I didn't say all Islam, I'm saying Wahhabist Islam of the Saudi version, evangelical American right-wing post-Trump Christianity, this is the enemy of our human future. And we have to unite to fight this and educate people out of it and grab the young people and talk to them before these folks get into their brains and turn them all into Amy Coney Barrett, sitting there smiling and lying through her teeth to the Senate saying, I don't have a view on this, while in her head she's carrying on a little prayer meeting saying, oh, Lord, give me the words so I can fool them this one more day and get in there and do all the great things you've called me to do.
Yeah. Once
and
I'm on the bench.
That's what she's doing.
Oh, absolutely. Get me out of this thing and get me on the bench. And then
her heroes are all Israelite generals who massacred whole other tribes led by God to lie through their teeth when they invaded people's cities and then slaughter everyone doing God's will. Yeah. That's who these people's heroes are. So, you know, my view, very passionately stated, I know.
Yeah.
And I hope I don't sound too crazy, but my view is this. Listen. Dancing around the religious liberty issue and saying, oh, we won't criticize her faith because that's anti-religious. We have to change the rules and say, you know, you're running for public office. Everything you are is our business. There are no off limits here. Show me your tax returns. Tell me where you go to church. What makes you tick? What do you do? How do you treat your wife? Yeah, it is my business. You're going to be put in a position of power for a lifetime over me and my grandchildren. Damn right I want to know. And yes, we're going to pry into your affairs. So I think this kind of secular reticence to get into religious debates with these guys is ridiculous. And that we just have to look them right in the face and say what I just said. We're not going to back off one iota. What you believe and who you are is one and the same thing. We all operate on a belief system. You have a right to yours, and I have a right to know what it is.
And yet, as you say, we are screwed because, they're not representative of your view and my view. And in fact, the majority of Americans don't even support what this whole hearing right now. They don't want any judge, let alone Amy Coney Barrett, anyone put through weeks before the election. The majority of Americans do not want this to happen, and yet they're doing it anyway. And when she gets on the bench, as you say, we're not going to have a say in any of the rulings at all. And right. So a minority of Americans is dictating what the majority are going to be for the next 30, 40 plus years as she sits on the bench. Now, I got one last question for you. If you've got a minute, you talk about this and it's related. I'll bring this around to explain how this works. But I watched that movie, Let Me Be Frank, which was really fascinating. If anyone hasn't seen that, I might put the link to it in the show notes. And you talk about this litmus test of evangelicalism, going back to the fundamentalists about a century ago or so. So there was a change there whereby they decided that we need to make a litmus test of what you believe That's what determines whether or not you're a true Christian. Now, the question is, you talk about this kind of explains the evangelical cruelty that we see in the support of Trump today. Can you sort of tie that together and explain how that works?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, you know, once you reduce your faith to a series of political litmus tests of in or out, black or white, you have essentially gotten rid of not only all the nuance and all the paradox of real spirituality, which is always a form of questioning and doubt. It's never belief. It's always to do with the questions you're asking and the journey you're on. So essentially what you always are returning to is a kind of a sophomoric faith, which has a checklist of things that, quote, make you a Christian. The shift in my life that I've seen in the last 68 years is that that checklist used to be spiritual things. Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? Do you believe in the virgin birth, the resurrection, and Jesus' return in the rapture of the saints if you were from one particular denominational background? Then it became sort of arcane theological things. Do you believe in predestination? Do you believe in this Calvinism, this kind of Lutheran idea of the sacraments? There were always spiritual things. The checklist now, you probably go down 30 or 40 points before you run into the first question about God, let alone anything to do with Christianity. So it's, what's your view of gun rights? What's your view of homosexuality? What's your view of abortion? What's your view of the role of women in the family? What's your view of women having careers? What's your view of non-Christian countries, or as Trump calls them, shithole countries, or whatever he used those terms? You go all the way down the list, and you know, this list hardens people to political positions which basically undo all the ideas of Christian charity. So for instance, somewhere down that checklist is, you know, do you believe in putting people in cages and separating children and families on the border to keep brown people out of our country? Check. Now, if you want to look at the ultimate moment of hypocrisy that I just really, really, even though I've used this example, every time I say it, I can hardly believe I'm saying this, but it's true. You know, if Trump was a political leader in England in the Brexit era, trying to get out of Europe and stop immigration into the UK, or if even more so, he was a leader in Greece or in Italy, where the southern border on the other side of the Mediterranean is the Arab-controlled Islamic nations and northern Africa. And he was talking about keeping alien cultures out of Europe, that this is a Western European white Christian nation and we've got to keep it pure. He would be wrong. But you would understand that he was standing against something that actually could be argued as different enough so that if you had a majority Muslim population, for instance, the character of your founding documents would change or whatever. You could make an argument. Here's the ultimate irony of the hypocrisy of this religious right movement. The wall they are building,
trying to build.
The kids they are putting, the 50 feet of it that hasn't fallen down.
All right. That Mexico's paying for.
The kids that they put in cages, the families that are being rounded up by ICE and dragged out of their beds in the nighttime. Excuse me, if you're trying to defend Christian civilization and Judeo-Christian teaching and a Christian way of life and even a pro-life, pro-marriage, anti-adultery way of life, you name it. If you even want some homophobia thrown in, name it. Guess who's being dragged back over the border and sent home as families are being split up? Pentecostal Christians and conservative Roman Catholics who happen to be brown people. So anybody who says that Trump is defending America in terms of a Judeo-Christian heritage of a Christian nation, who then turns around and says they want to keep our borders closed to this wave of political asylum seekers, you would think that they were talking about keeping people from a genuinely philosophically alien nation out. The lie that is given to them and the absolute proof of their racism to the core is that the very people they're trying to keep out are the very people that if they were welcomed would all be voting Republican in the next election if it came down to lifestyle issues of homosexuality, abortion, promiscuous sex, and so forth. These are conservative Central Americans who go to small Pentecostal, happy, clappy, speak in tongues churches, just like Amy Coney Barrett does, except she's part of a white entitled elite and they are not. Hmm. And to me, of all the crazy bullshit that's been going on in the Trump years, if you just want to pull one thread out of which the whole edifice then crumbles, this is it. Why are you shutting the southern border to your own people?
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't tell it all, then nothing does. Because if you wanted a pro-life vote, if you wanted a pro-family vote, if you wanted a pro-hard work by your bootstraps vote, if you wanted people who even believe probably in gun ownership and defend whatever it is, you're talking to South and Central American folks and Mexicans who come from a Pentecostal Christian background and or conservative Roman Catholic. There's not an atheist in that caravan. They all believe what you believe, and you're shutting your effing door.
Just because of the color of their skin.
Yeah, so don't talk to me about defending Western civilization against godless humanism and all these other guys. If Barrett and Trump and Falwell Jr., before he was found watching the pool boy having sex with his wife, you know, whatever, if they were serious about their agenda, they would throw the door open and they'd say, listen, the only sure defense of Western democracy, and by the way, so we can keep up with the population of China and have some sort of fighting chance in the 21st and 22nd century of having any presence on this globe at all, is going to be to welcome these caravans of folks in who believe what we believe and do everything we can. Come to our church, so on and so on. These are the true believers. These are the most fervent Christians in the world right now, are South and Central Americans. Mm. And American white evangelicals have shut their door, and there's absolutely no other reason but race, which gives the lie to the whole damn thing. And so in the end, all of these fine words only really amount to a form of white nationalism. And that's where we've come to.
And as you say, it's even worse than shutting the door. They're putting them in cages. They're separating them from their families. So they're actually being cruel. And like you say, statistics bear that out, because some of the fastest growing churches numerically are the Protestant Pentecostal churches filled with Hispanic immigrants. So if these churches are losing white members, you know, left, right, and center, but if it wasn't for the Hispanic immigrants and South American immigrants, they wouldn't have a congregation. That's some of the fastest growing movement.
Yeah, they read in the news about white vigilante groups traveling hundreds of miles so they can get a shot at these people as they swim across a river. The person you just shot, you a-hole, is a Pentecostal pastor from an Assemblies of God church in some little village, you jerk.
Just happened to be from South America or Mexico. Ideologically, religiously, they're on the same exact page. That's a great point. I never thought of it that way. Obviously, the systemic racism, like you say, it gives the lie to all the rhetoric around, you know, keeping America pure, keeping America white again. Their deep roots in systemic racism is being revealed, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you wanted America to remain a quote unquote Christian country for the next 500 years, you'd open your southern borders.
Sure. Let them flood in.
And say, hey, these are our brothers and sisters in Christ. Welcome.
Absolutely. Come in with open arms. Where can people find you? Where can they get a hold of your works? What's the best place to find you online?
Well, they can find me online where everybody is. And that is, I've got a Facebook page and also on Twitter. But, you know, with the politicized times we live in, of course, I put a lot of stuff up there and I have a lot of followers. But if they really want to actually get into what I think and what I hope and all the rest, I would much rather than someone going to Facebook, go to Amazon and maybe read one of my novels like Portofino, which is a coming of age story about growing up in an evangelical missionary family that has, by the way, I think helped a lot of former evangelicals make that break through humor, not through hard hitting political analysis, or my memoir, Crazy for God, or my most recent little offering, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, which is really about this ambivalent relationship between people raised in a Christian background and then how one changes one's mind but tries to hold on to something of the inheritance of a spiritual life in which when you get up in the morning, there's someone to thank for the fact that you're still breathing and so forth and so on. So for those who want to track the journey, I would really hope you'd look at my books rather than just go online and track with whatever my latest screed is on Twitter.
Right.
That said, Facebook, if you would join my Facebook, that would be great because I announce projects there that actually have some meaning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you give me the link to this when put it up because I want to send some of the folks who look at my stuff to your podcast and get you some more people to listen to it.
Thank you. Yeah, I've done a lot of work on Dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism, the Christian right. So talking to you, that's why I reached out to you. And I was going to say, I don't know if you're up for it, but maybe at some point we could come back around in another time when things settle down. Maybe by then we can set up another recording if you want to do that. I would love to talk about that.
I'd love to do that. So I don't know when you're going to put this one up, let me know so I can send people to listen to it because I think we've had a good discussion. And then if you want to double back and we'll do another session after you read Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, let's do that.
All right, that is a done deal. I will do that. Thank you so much for chatting with me. I've absolutely enjoyed meeting up with you.
Hey, it's really great. Thank you. It's been nice getting to know you a little bit.